This is Barry Peters, recorded at his home at Yaxham near Dereham in Norfolk by Chris Alden Lee on the 1st of September 2010. Barry Peters, Part 1.
My name is Barry John Peters and my date of birth was 7/01/1938 and I was born in Bexley Heath in Kent.
So you're now 72.
72.
Okay. And tell me a bit more about your childhood. What sort of childhood did you have?
Lived at Barnhurst during the first part of the war and watched the sky over St Paul's light up when they were blitzing it. And then in 1942 or 3, and I can't remember which, moved to a little village called Beltinge on the Kent coast, very close to Herne Bay. And that's where I spent my childhood. And my parents took over a grocery shop there. My father was actually a machinist at Vickers in Crayford, making bits for guns, and was essentially medically lifted out and took over this quiet little grocery store. So that's where I grew up, sailing and swimming and doing all the things one does on the coast.
What sort of senior schooling did you have?
Grammar school in Faversham. For me, wrong education. I should have gone to a technical school.
Oh, really? Why do you say that?
My bent was always towards the technical side, anything from surveying to metalwork, woodwork, rather than languages and higher maths, etc. And at that stage, you could go to a secondary school at 11 and then go on to a technical college at 13, which would have been better for me. But so I left grammar school at 16 with sort of a couple of O-levels and went straight into college to qualify as a radio officer for the Merchant Navy.
So what came first, wanting to be a sailor or wanting to be involved in radio?
Wanting to be a sailor, but with my eyesight, you couldn't do a navigation course then. There was no navigators with glasses, if you like. And heavy engineering, living in an engine room, didn't fancy it, so decided that radio was the thing to do.
So had you actually had crystal sets as a lad? Or?
No, not at all. I don't know why I did that, in fact, but having got my ticket to operate, I decided that after all spending 2 to 3 years without seeing UK, or because voyages in those days were pretty long, it didn't appeal, just staring at the sea day after day. So at that time I was coming up 18 and was called up into the RAF, where I played about with radar for 3.5 years before Crown agents said, "We need you," having had an interview for FIDS in the May. Come June, they said, "We need you," and within 3 days I was out of the RAF.
How did the interview for FIDS come about? Was it something you saw?
I saw it in Telegraph. In fact, I'd seen it the year before in the Overseas Telegraph when I was in Cyprus with the RAF. And this was in 59, the year I was due home. I'd spent 2.5 years in Cyprus by then. And said, "Oh, I wouldn't mind applying for that." So I saw it the following year in 1960, applied for it, and got a job as an ionospheric assistant.
What made you apply?
I think a number of things. The fact my family was breaking up and my parents were breaking up. I'd got wanderlust anyway. I didn't fancy a 9-to-5 job. And the thought of going south was quite interesting. Not necessarily as a radio officer, but radio operator. But to maybe further my knowledge of the ionosphere and things like this, because you do a little bit on your radio course for merchant service about the heavy side layers and bits and pieces. So I thought this would be interesting. But the funny part was at the interview, if the, I forget who it was, probably John Green or Bill Sloan, said to me, well, if there's no post for an ionospheric assistant or technician, how would you like to become a meteorologist? So I thought, fine. If that's all that's on offer, then fine, yes, I'll do it.
So let's backtrack a little bit. Can you remember your first connection or knowledge of the Antarctic? What was your first brush? Was it that famous film?
I think probably the famous film, yes.
Scott of the Antarctic?
Yes. I think that it stirs the imagination. I mean, I didn't like the ending particularly, but it does stir the imagination. But apart from that, I don't think I had too much knowledge of what I was getting into. Yes, you know, you look at an Antarctic map and you think, "Cor, it's a big place," you know. But I had very little knowledge, if any, of the bases. So I was quite fortunate, I think, to get it.
What do you remember of the interview? Bearing in mind it was 50 years ago.
I think probably having a cup of tea with Spode teacups. Why I should remember that, I don't know, but I think it was probably Bill Sloman, who was a wonderful character, had a very almost acerbic sense of humour. Was talking about, "We'll have tea out of the Spode, please." This was at Crown Agents, of course, at that time, just down the road from Crown Agents in Gayfair Street.
So just so I can understand this, and did you apply to FIDS or to Crown Agents, or were they...
No, FIDS, but Crown Agents were interlinked with FIDS at that time quite strongly. It was quite a marriage, and in fact, FIDS rented... Or had use of offices at the back end of Crown Agents, which is on Millbank, and down Gayfair Street there's another sort of separate office, which was quite fun in itself, because I actually worked there for about 3 months going through geophysical records for one of the geophysicists there, a guy called Joe Farman, who you may have met.
This was when you got back, wasn't it?
No, this is a bit before I went.
Oh, right, OK. Well,
I did a course at... What happened was that once I got out of the RAF in June, I shouldn't have come out until September, I had a course at Slough on how to read ionograms, E layers and F layers and et cetera, and do the calculation tabulations on maximum usable frequencies and all the things you do with ionospherics. And then, having finished that course, I was at a loose end from sort of October, November until we sailed at the beginning of December. So I spent a couple of months in Gayfair House, travelling to London each day. My mother by that time had moved to Wimbledon, so it was a relatively easy journey. And working for Joe, and that was a fascinating building, because Anne Todd, who you also probably know, do you know Anne?
Bad reputation, was wonderful
lady. Wonderful lady. To get to Anne's office from where we were up in the garret, you had to go all the way down to the ground floor, across the hallway, auditorium, whatever you like to call it, at the front, or and then right up another staircase, the other side. You couldn't just go across. You had to go all the way around. So, yeah, it was quite fun. You used to fly paper aeroplanes out of the window and watch the crowds looking up as these things came floating down. And
so you're on the top floor?
We're right in the garret.
Well, describe us. What, if you, in your mind's eye, you're remembering those offices now. Describe them to me.
I don't know, small, cramped, as I say, right up in the gods. Great fun. You could look across into where all the ladies were working in the offices across the road, which used to hang out of the window and wave at them, and as one did when you were 20 or just gone.
What colour was it?
Sorry?
What colour?
The offices? Yeah. I can't honestly remember, but I would guess a dark, creamy, dirty colour, and maybe a bit of green. It seems to be...
How many people would be there?
Oh, in the whole of the offices, there was one, two, so Viv plus Joe, myself, Mike and Todd, probably a finance officer. I'm not sure who that would have been at that time. Probably about eight or nine. Not very many. It's always been, certainly in FID's days and in the first bit of when it became Bass, quite a small head office.
You know, what was Joe for Farman like in those days? I mean,
Joe is Joe. Joe has always been the same. If you've met him, you've met Joe as I knew him when he was in Edinburgh or down here, you know, in Cambridge. Never changes. Got a wonderful record collection, one of the most hideous records you've ever heard, apart from some really wonderful ones. But very, very odd character, but a great bloke.
Did you detect a great scientist at work?
Not really. Very quiet, puffs his pipe. I don't know whether he's still smoking, because he must be getting on now. He's a bit older than me. Not really, I don't think. Somebody who knew what he was doing, and somebody with a very good mind. But as for being great, if I can put that in sort of inverted commas, no, very down-to-earth sort of guy. No.
Did you get on with him?
Yes, very well. In fact, I stayed with him in Edinburgh a couple of times. But I used to go up there after I came back and started working for Bass again in 69. Part of my remit, apart from radio, was all sorts of other things, like doing all the meteorology indents, the geophysics indents, and, you name it. Could be post office, getting franks for the stamps and things like this. Carting met instruments back to Negretti and Zambra or whoever in London or wherever, for Recal and so forth. But that was a few years later. That was, let's say.
What did you know about ionospherics when you were recruited?
I knew the basics, because they give you those on the radio course, because of course in those days there was no satellites. It was all HF communications, and so Morse code was the thing, and you had to know a little about what was happening in the ionosphere and what sort of times of day you could get through to UK to Portishead Radio or wherever, and so I knew a little bit about the layers, but obviously I learnt a lot more at Slough, at the Radio and Space Research Station.
How developed was the science in those days? Had they discovered most of what there was to discover?
Oh, yes. No, it was pretty thoroughly discovered. And I mean, the RSRS at Slough, or Radio Research Station as it was then, RRS, was pretty well up. And they had a world data centre there. So, of course, when we came back from Halley and from Faraday, or as it now is, or it's Vernadsky, I think, now, we guys used to sit down and sort out all the results and get them in tabular form to go into the World Data Centre for publication. So, yes, it was a huge number of these ionospheric stations, all taking vertical soundings, whether it was in Hyderabad or wherever in the States, in Australia or down south, up north. They're all tabulated. So at any time of day, you could actually find out what sort of frequencies you should be using.
So I know we're leaping ahead now, but you're yep. working in the Antarctic. Were you actually almost day by day deciding which frequencies the radio operators should use?
No, because you only get an overhead reading, of course. And down south, especially at Halley in the auroral belt, anything can happen, and literally usually does. And there could be days, if we had aurora, when you wouldn't go anywhere. There wouldn't be a peep on the radio. You couldn't get the met out, you couldn't get air letters out or in, you couldn't get the temperatures out or in. So it used to be a massive pile-up. Now, I wasn't there as a radio op, but I did used to do a bit of radio operating to help the operators out. And there was two in my first year. There was the base leader, Colin Johnson, and a guy called Eric Jones, who is sadly no longer with us. He died quite young. And obviously they were used to get fairly fraught. Well, Colin was being base leader, had a lot of other work to do, and we were constructing a new base at the same time. So it was quite hectic that first year. So I used to sort of muck in and help where I could.
What I'm trying to get a picture of is the kind of work you were doing whilst you were down there and what that was adding to the overall knowledge of ionospherics.
Well, what we were doing was taking a continuous recording of what the ionospheric layers were doing above us. And then the following day, or when the film had finished, every 3 days or whatever it was, because it was 70 millimeter paper film then, onto it, or from an oscilloscope, you'd sit down and tabulate all the different parameters, FOE, FOF1, FOF2, etc., etc. And you'd look at an ionogram looks like this, various layers, as sort of curves, if you like, and you'd take those off and measure them to see what frequencies they were giving you, because the equipment itself used to go from about, I think it was 0.8 megacycles right up to 22 or something like this. So those results weren't transmitted back. They were sent out at the end of the year.
On paper.
And then eventually they'd be put into sort of book form, if you like, and put through the World Data Centre so that anybody could look at them. And from that you can draw maps rather like meteorological maps of barometric pressure and so forth. And from those, anywhere in the world, if you've got this data, you could see what sort of frequencies you'd need to reach wherever you were going, whether it was Australia or...
So the implication being that the scenario would be the same again the next year and the year after that?
No, it does change, because it changes according to sunspot cycle, etc., which is an 11-year cycle. So things change quite dramatically between sunspot min and sunspot max, and you get a lot more solar flares and other horrid effects, which, as I say, cut your communications to zero, if you like. Certainly on HF. Not, satellites aren't quite as badly affected.
So how valuable then was the data, looking back at it now, how valuable was the data you were collecting?
Yes, I think because it all helped. It was part of the big picture, if you like. In itself, it probably wasn't all that valuable. But tied together with Faraday and all the other stations, as I say, everywhere from Hyderabad to Baghdad to wherever, they had all these ionospheric stations all pinging radio waves directly upwards, then it was part of the big picture. Intrinsically in itself, probably only a small part, only of small importance, if you like.
Were the stations in the Southern Hemisphere, were they all using similar equipment? Or was the equipment in the Antarctic? I think I met the guy who developed it, actually. Was the equipment in the Antarctic different?
Not really, no. It was built... I mean, most of the ones that we used... I'm sure that the Australians built their own and the Americans built their own, but all working on a very similar premise, all giving essentially similar results. It was actually built by Union Radio in Croydon, this machine, but it was developed in 1930... Gosh, it was pretty agricultural. It must have been 1935 or 6 by a chap called Roy Piggott. And he was brilliant. He really was one of the world authorities on ionospherics and the ionosphere. An amazing man. I have so much respect for him.
You met him?
I worked for him.
Tell me a bit more about him. Why are you in awe of him?
He's the typical mad professor. He'd appear... If he was giving it... I saw him lecture after I'd left Bass, before I came back to it in 69, I worked for Marconi's, and I attended a series of lectures at Leicester University. And Piggott's there with his tie round here, his shoes covered in mud and the laces undone, and his arms going hot and holy, but he could explain things to idiots like me. I mean, he was so far above my plane. He'd studied under Edward Appleton. I think he got a degree when he was about 18 or 19. He was that bright. And he'd worked for Appleton. And he'd never bothered to take another degree. You know, he was so much old hat, you know, he'd got enough to go on with. An amazing man, had an incredible... During the war, he was working on, I think, everything from the fusing of shells to, you know, proximity fusing and to the ionosphere to almost splitting the atom. You know, it was one of these jobs that it could go anywhere. And after the war, they dressed him up as a wing commander and sent him to Germany to get hold of some of the German scientists and engineers that had been working at Lindau, which is the German Ionospheric Institute, or was in those
days. On Lake Constance.
Sorry?
Yes. On Lake Constance.
Yeah. And Piggott almost had his own private army. He was a bit like Popsky. And by subterfuge, blackmail, and employing anybody you could find that was a scheming little monkey, he'd sort of deal on the black market. He'd do anything to get these guys out and you know, borrow trucks from various places without people's permission. So he's quite an amazing guy. But as I say, he was one of these guys, you walk into his office and you tell him, look, he'd asked me to maybe sort out some papers for him. And you go into his office and you say, I can't find these papers anywhere. And his office was a bit squarer than this conservatory. Piles of papers everywhere. You couldn't see the desk. I mean, that was, you know, gone, long gone. And he'd say, just a minute. And he'd go, he knew exactly where everything was. And they had a lady came in from well after the war. This is when I was back there sometime later. Lady came in from Germany to Hannah, who was going to tie his office up, which he duly did. And of course, he couldn't find a thing. But when he got a promotion, I'll always remember, had an old standard 8 drophead car, and he came roaring back through the gates into Radio Research Station, sagging at the springs with crates of beer in the back. You know, he's this sort of guy. Just a wonderful bloke. Absolutely marvellous.
And what was the context in which you worked for him?
When I came back, this was in 63... I acted as a gopher for him, and I'd say pick up bits of information. I'd built some bits of equipment up for IQSY, which was 63-4. Things like that. And in fact, he was instrumental in getting me my job with Marconi, because he sent me across to Marconi's... Sorry, in between times. Sorry, I'm going a bit ahead of myself.
Doesn't matter.
When I came back, I obviously, as I say, we were tabulating the results. The three of us came back, 2 from Halley, 1 from Faraday. And having done that, we were, as I say, pottering about. We were virtually due to leave Bass, or yes, it was Bass by then. And the assistant director came into the office one day where the three of us were working and said, who'd like to go to Kenya? Well, the other two were going back to university. Mike was doing a chemistry degree. I'm not sure what Ted was doing. But anyway, so I said, well, I'm free, I'll go. So I did a 9-month contract for Royal Society, taking an ionospheric equipment out to Kenya, setting it up, building the masts and setting all the areas up, teaching a local how to use it. You know, working out of the university in Nairobi. And so I had 9 months of that. And it's when I came back to Slough. And my wife worked at Slough, in fact, and we were engaged-ish. So, as I say, I went to work for Piggott as a gopher again. And one day he sent me across to Marconi with some information for a chap called Les Barclay, who was part of the ionospheric team at Halley during IGY. So having got to Mark Harney's in Chelmsford, or Great Baddow, to the research centre, had a chat with Les. He said, oh, come and meet the group leader. It's a chap called Gerald Eisted, who was a Pathfinder pilot during the war. And anyway, got offered a job. So since I was getting married a week later and was effectively out of work, I couldn't really turn it down. So that's how it all happened. And then after 5 years there with Mark Harney, GEC had taken over, basically, and you could see the writing on the wall. I'm not sure how it happened, how I heard there was a job going at Bass. So anyway, I applied and went through the civil service performance one does to get in on probation, as it were, and remained there till I retired.
Well, that was your second spell at Bass.
We'll come, yes.
We will, yeah. Let's go back a little bit.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sorry, I'm rabbiting.
No, it's absolutely fine. All the right information, any order will do, as Eric Morgan might say. Where does a beastie fit into the work you were doing?
It was a beamed electronic automatic
signal transmitter.
I can't remember. There was the beastie and the bastard. The bastard was Stewart's, and that was the auroral bit. Beamed electronic automatic stellar and terrestrial ionospheric equipment. I think it was.
Right.
Sorry, did you get that?
I got that, yeah, that's fine.
The bastard I can't remember, but it was something about beamed automatic, something to do with Aurora. And that was a Sheffield experiment, in fact.
But, so it was a beastie you were using?
It was a beastie, yeah. It was a Union Radio Mark II, as it's known. As I say, pretty agricultural. It was electromechanical. Which caused all sorts of untold headaches, but...
How do you mean?
Well, just maintaining it. Contact. I mean, it had a ring of... I can't remember exactly. I think it was about 56 brass contacts around it, hitting little pads. I got copper strips on and so forth. And these, of course, always wore. And, for example, in that time, of course, you only had... Because communications weren't good... You couldn't just ring up and say, can you send me another set? It was, please send me some, just a few, anything. Otherwise, you're down to making them, which wasn't always easy. It was that sort of thing that caused problems. You know, it's just headaches. But fine, that's part of the job.
Did you ever get results you weren't expecting? Was it all very...
Yeah, I mean...
Predictable.
Sporadic E, for example, does all sorts of funny things. I can't remember any that I can recall. I can recall one or two things that have happened since where some years ago we had a pilot who was flying into Punta Arenas in southern Chile. And he heard I think it must have been a B-Cal aircraft, British Caledonian at that time, aircraft calling on finals. And he assumed going into Sao Paulo on VHF. In fact, he was going into Gatwick. Now, what happens is that very occasionally, with VHF signals, which are effectively line of sight, what you get is it hits a layer... And it ducks right the way through this layer and then suddenly drops out at the other end. So it goes incredible distances. I mean, it's very unusual, but it does happen. I mean, there's that sort of thing. But, I mean, when you're working at Halley, I don't think we've ever seen anything like that on HF, if you like. We used to do quite a bit on of amateur work. We've virtually all had amateur licences.
Radio ham, maybe.
Yeah. Again, there was quite interesting things happened there where you'd find that instead of being able to use the direct route across the continent to, say, New Zealand, it was better to go right round the globe. And it was actually clearer on HF, and this was Morse code, of course, go right round the globe, or occasionally voice if conditions were very good, rather than go the direct route. So there's odd things like that happen. That was all due to the aurora and solar flares and bits and pieces, you know.
So that makes me think that ionospheric isn't a particularly precise or exact science.
No, anything but. In later years, when I worked for Marconi, I did a series of experiments with a communications centre up in Yorkshire. And I had a piece of equipment there which was very much more advanced, where I could actually tell the communications duty officer that in half an hour that frequency that he was using to reach wherever would drop out and he'd have to go to a lower frequency. And there was looks of amazement, but it did actually work. But as I say, that was very much more advanced and a lot further down the line, if you like. This was in the 60s, mid-60s.
Was it the fact that it was inexact? Was that where the interest lay?
Yes, I think so. It was more an art form than a science, if you like, in certain respects anyway. That and just the general life down there is brilliant.
Well, let's go now to your departure. You left on the Kista Down in December 1960.
Yes.
And
we stopped at Cape Verde for either fuel or water. Montevideo, spent 3 days having a riot, a last swim, etc., on the beach at Monte, and a lot of steak. And then sailed for Stanley, where we arrived on New Year's Day.
61,
which was not an ideal occasion to arrive, because if you'd prodded any of our people that worked there with a finger, they'd have shattered like cut glass. They were absolutely stocious. Well, not surprising. Stanley at that time was a bit of a Wild West town. It really was brilliant fun. We had quite a big office there then, because it was sort of SecFed, the finance officer, quite a big stores, all the clothing stores were there. So all the functions, if you like, of a virtually a head office. And all the communications out of the Antarctic from all the bases went to Stanley. So if you wanted a camera or 10 crates of beer or whatever, you go to Stanley. You know. But, quite an interesting place at that time.
When you say Wild West,
you could get banned from the local pubs, or you could ban yourself from the local pubs, and things used to happen. there was a lot of pranksters there, and I remember the finance officer, who again sadly is no longer with us, but a great character, riding bareback on a cow.
What was his name?
Down Philomel Hill, Eric Salmon. Great character. Used to play tricks in the office on the girls. He was leafing through the phone book one day and he found Lambeth Palace. So he rang Jill, his secretary, and said, can you ring this number and ask for Mr. Bishop? So she rings up. She didn't see the funny side of it for about an hour. She rings up Lambeth Palace and this spectral voice asked for Mr. Bishop, and this sort of voice on the other end said, "We have a lot of bishops here, my dear." So it was that sort of character, you know. I think Fids breeds them a bit. I mean, one of the guys got married, not one of the Bass guys, but somebody that everybody knew. So when he was getting stocious with his bride in the pub, they emptied his house of every stick of furniture. So that was the sort of thing that happened, you know. And Eric lived next to the Reverend in Stanley, and the Reverend kept geese, and they used to annoy Eric. So one night he nipped over the fence and wrung this goose's neck. So 3 days later he invites the Rev to dinner and, of course, produces this goose. So the Rev doesn't know what has happened to his goose. And says, "Very nice goose, this." And says, "Yeah, it should be. It's one of yours." So things like that used to happen quite frequently.
Was there nevertheless a sense of organisation?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. It was organised. It had to be. And in general, it worked pretty well. You know, it was only small, but it was a tight organisation. Because, of course, you only got one chance every year to get supplies in and out, for example. You know, you couldn't just ring up and say, can you get me some next week? So you had to be pretty rigorous about what you were asking for. And on the other hand, the other end had to be pretty rigorous in getting it for you if they possibly could. Mm. And that still continues today, or it certainly continued until I left, I suppose, 12 years ago. It had got a lot more, obviously, technically, and a lot broader in that, of course, whereas we used to dig a hole in the ice within the hut somewhere and build a two-hole around it, nowadays, of course, it's all got to be either composted, tanked out, same with waste, same with buildings. I mean, last time I saw, I guess it was Halley 1.5 or Halley 2, it was appearing through the ice shelf as we came steaming into towards Halley. There was this building sticking out about 50, 60 feet down. Of course, you couldn't do that now, but it's fair enough.
Tell me about your trip south then from Stanley. What do you recall? Because obviously these are very much first impressions, particularly for a new recruit.
From Stanley, we went to South Georgia, I think, or I'm not sure whether we went Bird Island first, and we dropped two guys, Lance Tickell, who worked, or must be retired now, but worked eventually for BBC Bristol, for the wildlife people, and a guy called Harry Dolman, who'd been down before. We certainly stopped in South G, and they were still whaling at that time, so that was quite fascinating, because there was a hell of a storm, and we got stuck in there for a couple of days. And the catchers brought their whales in onto the plan for flensing. So that was quite an interesting, quite a gory. And you could smell South Georgia 20 miles away. You really could. You got used to it fairly quickly, but fascinating place. We went to Admiralty Bay and picked up some dogs, because we had four pups given to us by Lauritsen's, the shipping people, Kister's owners, which we brought down from UK. They were great fun to have on board, they really were. But anyway, we picked up more dogs from there. And then, I'm not sure whether we called at Sydney or not, I can't remember. The shipping records should be able to sort that one out. Or whether we went straight to Halley. And we arrived at Halley, I don't know, sometime mid-January, I guess.
Did you have any idea what you were going to? And when you got there, was it as you expected?
I had a little idea, because obviously on the way down we had people who had been down before, not necessarily to Halley, but certainly had been south before. When I got there, I think I was just awestruck by it. Absolutely amazing place. Really is.
How do you mean?
Well, it's suddenly like being a goldfish in a bowl of milk. You know, it's all white. That sort of, just an impression of, God, this is incredible. You know, I've never seen anything like it. Yes.
Yeah.
It has a beauty of its own. I mean, Halley is not, when you compare it to somewhere like the Lemaire Channel or up on the peninsula, it's a different sort of beauty. I mean, it's like comparing, if you like, the Isle of Skye with Norfolk. You know, there is no comparison. So it's two totally different things, but both in their own way, absolutely superb.
What sort of state was the base in when you arrived? Because it wasn't pristine, was it, by any means? I don't believe.
No, but it was incredibly strong. It was built by A.V. Rowe. It was the old base, the original base. I think it was A.V. Rowe. And it was built on a diamond formation. And that has its own drawbacks, because it means your corridors are very narrow, if you like. It was one long hut, effectively, with a little generator shed on the end. but incredibly strong. Yes, it was about 30 feet, 40 feet down when we got there, because it had been built in 56. And Halley is in an area which does create a lot of drift. You know, there's a lot of drift there.
Accumulations. Yeah.
Accumulation. So, yeah, it was different.
Was it creaking?
Not particularly, no. No, I mean, it dripped a bit with water and, you know, where the heat was getting out and so forth. But, no, not, I didn't find it creaky particularly, not at that time. And we had a lot of people on base that year because there was something like 30 people on base, which is a hell of a lot to pack into quite a small hut. Because we had builders and all sorts of people and tractor mechs and so forth. As I say, you live like a troglodyte a bit. I mean, the big saving grace, I suppose, is that as far as we were concerned, our hut was 1,500 yards away, so you had to go out every day. Didn't matter what the weather was like, you had to go out. So, yeah, it was okay. I think because a lot of people down there at that time were ex-services, it was no great hardship. I mean, I'd lived in a tent for 2.5 years, effectively, from the lowlands around Kyrenia right up to the top of Troodos on Olympus in Cyprus, which is 6,500 feet. So, you know, you were used to, if you like, roughing it in a small way. And, I mean, the clothing wasn't bad. It wasn't wonderful because it was essentially ex-services or service clothing. So if you were lucky, you got naval trousers, which were relatively soft, or you got army trousers, which chafed your thighs to bits. But you had, you know, string vests and woolly shirts and big jumpers and so forth.
Was there ever any fear that it might cave in?
No.
This weight of ice above?
No, no.
Were there good physics reasons why that couldn't happen?
I don't think anybody bothered about it, to be honest. I don't think, you know. I mean, okay, if the roof had started sort of going like this, I'm sure people would have said, you know, maybe. But we were building another base at the same time, which was Harbrow's Folly, as it was known. I don't know whether you've come across that one.
Again?
It's called Harbrow's Folly. Halley 1.5. Built in 62. It was sandwich ply panels with wires running through so they could be pulled together tight. Flat roof. Girder frames on the inside. Major problem, they'd only put in about 1/4 of the bolts required to put the framework together. So it only lasted, in fact, one of my colleagues who was back from the first time I was at Halley was back down as base leader in 60, must have been 65, and the roof caved in. So they had a hell of a winter with just plastic sheet over the roof, and not a nice year to be there.
And the name you gave it again was
Harbrow's Folly, built by a company called Harbrow. Now, who was responsible for lack of bolts, nuts to put the damn thing together? I'm not sure. But again, when we were there, of course, it was brand new because we'd built the thing. So there was a bunk room block, then a little corridor and a main living block. So it was built sort of like that. The interesting thing was before I left, one of our guys lost his false teeth one night down the loo, and unfortunately he's dead now. He's a great friend of mine.
What was his name?
John Holt.
Was he the cook?
Yes. Yeah, and he died of cancer 18 months ago, 2 years ago now. But I used to see him regularly when we went to Scotland, he and his wife, and we used to get together. And poor old John lost some of his teeth, and we dangled him down the hole, which fortunately hadn't been used because it was the inaugural party, if you like, for this wonderful new building, and found that there was a whacking great fissure running right under the bunk room section. So So everybody trod very carefully after that. It was sort of setting on the bearers okay, but there was this great big crack. It's obviously opened up a crevasse or something. But no, again, nobody seemed too bothered by it. You know, it wasn't going to fall in the hole, so fine, why worry?
How old was a cook then to have false teeth?
John wasn't very old. He was a lot younger than me. Well, not a lot younger, but I guess he was 20, 21. I was, what, 23?
But, did his teeth turn out?
Yes, yeah, he found them. They were on a ledge, fortunately. But, I mean, in those days, what you did was just got a load of paraffin, seal, blubber, anything you could, scrap, junk, stick it down on the snow and watch it gradually burn its way down and create this large hole. And that was your loo. And you used to have to chip all the icicles off it occasionally and with a big ice chisel. That was part of the Saturday gash job, you know.
So
it was pretty rough and ready.
Once produce remained down there, did it?
Sure, yeah. I mean, which is another thing that say can't happen today.
But it froze, therefore it wasn't
obnoxious. Sure, that's right. It wasn't obnoxious, no. I mean, the temperature at Halley, I think, has risen somewhat since then, but, I mean, when I was there, I think there was one day in 2 years it actually went to about plus 0.2 above freezing. And that's when you've got bright sunlight and no wind. But, I mean, I'm sorry, that's our toilet. I've got to fix it.
Don't worry.
I think we need a new... It's driving me nuts, that damn thing. I can't get it right. No, it was all pretty rough and ready, if you like. But great fun.
Did you find yourself having to do plumbing work in the Antarctic?
No.
Presumably you didn't spend all your time staring upwards, did you?
No. You used to get involved in, obviously, in the building project. All the labour was... Yeah.
I think she was just coughing.
All the labour was... All the gophers were people like me. The builders were directing, if you like, the chippies, and you were humping. So, yeah, it was fine. There was plenty to do. And the same on all the bases. You muck in on gash and you've got your set rota to do, you know, a day's gash, which is filling the water tanks and having your bath, treading your washing in the bath, because there wasn't washing machines down there in those days. So once a week you gaily trod up and down in the bath on all your dirty clothes, and that was it.
Effective?
Oh, up to a point. Only if you got too bad, you just sort of threw them away. But
were you doing much travelling at that time?
Started travelling. The first year, I had about 4 days out, I think. But that was, sadly, in August, which is the coldest month. Mm. And it got down to minus 50 plus. And that is no fun camping. We were looking for a depot, but there was a big crowd of us. It was not the way to travel.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, there was... I'm not sure whether it was one or two. I think it was one muskeg or two muskegs. We were looking for a depot about 40 or 50 miles away, maybe a bit more. And there was about eight of us on this trip just to get off base. And it was bitterly cold. And, of course, in a muskeg, there's only room for two or three in the cab. It's not like a big snowcat or something. And the rest of us were sitting on a Nansen sledge. And sitting on a Nansen sledge for any length of time not only gives you corns on your backside, but... you were frozen solid too. And you got to the stage where you were actually crying, trying to put the tent up and do the guy ropes and things. And after 4 days, it was obviously a waste of time. And later on that year, Colin and Dennis Ardus, a geologist, Colin Johnson, the base leader, and Dennis, who was a geologist, went off with a dog team and found it no problems, had a good trip. But that was slightly later and it was slightly warmer. In fact, they were travelling at night and sleeping during the day because the surface was better during the night because it was cooler. But second year I got out a bit, and in fact with John Holt, and we went up onto the inland ice and followed a tractor train up there and fitted a radio up on a little hut there and spent a couple of days poodling around doing very little, enjoying the scenery and being away from base.
So the travel was mainly recreational, was it?
Yes. Yeah, for me, it wasn't a field trip as such. Just recreation.
I gather there was there were jokers present at Halley as well at your time, during your time, is that right?
Jokers? Haircut jokers, yes.
Well, various jokers.
Well,
what do you remember?
Well, haircuts like hearts, clubs, diamonds and spades, for example, was one of them. I don't know about jokers.
Was there not an emperor penguin found in a state of unusual dress?
Yes. During the one I remember is Eric Jones. We'd all tied on a party the night before. Parties used to happen spontaneously. One night somebody would say, oh, I'm a bit fed up, let's get the beers out. So, you know, a group of you would get together. And lo and behold, next morning there was this really penguin that Mike Thurston had got in. We got several in fact, but this one's plodding its way up this corridor. And Eric's coming the other way, obviously absolutely pie-eyed, thinks he's got DTs, so he goes back to bed for a couple of days. But this penguin was wearing a bow tie, which probably made him think he perhaps ought to go back to bed.
Is Eric Salmon again?
No, this is Eric Jones, the radio op. Eric was, as I say, in Stanley. He'd been at Signy, I think, a couple of years before. But yeah, that was Eric Jones. I mean, that one I remember.
Mike Thurston was studying penguins, was he not?
Yes, he was, yeah.
What do you remember of that?
He used to have a little field hut down in Emperor Bay, right in the middle of the colony, or just up above the colony, in fact. We also used to take turns to spend maybe a week, or if it blew, you know, and they couldn't come down and pick you up, 2 weeks down there, just living on sort of hardtack rations and counting penguins, bisecting the odd penguin. See what had happened to it, if you like. But Mike disappeared. I've never heard from him since. He seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth. I don't know where he is now.
At the time, correct me if I've got this wrong, was he not actually keeping penguins in captivity?
Yeah, he kept about... There was half a dozen or so, and what he was doing was weighing them every morning. He had them in an ice cave. Now emperor penguins get something similar to silicosis if they're kept in captivity, so essentially they're all doomed, but for a while what he was doing was keeping them in the ice cave, and then every morning he'd bring them up into the corridor, into the bathroom, and weigh them on the scales really to see how much they were losing, and check their fat thickness and so forth, you know. That's the sort of experiment he was doing, and as I say, counting as well.
What the value of that was?
I don't know. I don't think he was working for a higher degree or anything. I don't think he was going to write a thesis on it. Mm. No, it's just one of those projects that somebody had said, I know, go forth and do this, you know.
Were there experiments being conducted on you, on the human beings as well?
Yes. Various things like... can't really remember. I think sort of immersing hands in cold water or fingers in cold water and things like this. Various other ones. David Eastie was the doctor in the first year I was there, a young doctor. And he was very good. And I think he was taking blood as well. He was blood sucking every year. Oh, God, the vampire's here again. You know.
Do you know why?
No. Medical MRC, medical research. You know, it all goes back to the... Somebody must do something with it, hopefully. I'd hate to think I'd give my blood in vain. But I don't know. I don't know what happened.
How were communications in the early 60s?
Sparse. That's what I was saying earlier. You know, I mean, some days you just couldn't get through to Stanley at all. And everything linked into Stanley. And Stanley then passed it through, with the government wireless station, passed it to... the World Data Centre, or World Met Centre, there's one in Chile, I think, either Chile or Argentina, and they passed all the information on there. And then eventually it went to Washington, to the sort of hub, if you like.
Was it all going out on Morse key?
All on CW, yeah. Yeah, all on Morse.
All letters?
Mainly groups, mainly five-figure groups, of course, all the Met temperature measurements. We were flying balloons every day. Getting pressure and so forth, and every 3-hourly OBS, That's why there's half a dozen meteorologists there, because it was covered 24 hours a day, every 3 hours.
Again, looking, I mean, I know that wasn't your speciality, but was that work that valuable, or was it just, again, part of routine?
Oh, routine in many ways, but again, you're looking at a worldwide network. You're not looking at individual stations. You're looking at being one of a mass of stations making, as I say, pressure maps, etc., and for the whole world. Now, what use they might be, because tongue-in-cheek I might add that despite all the million-pound computers, they don't seem to always get the weather right. Perhaps I should look out of the window occasionally. But it was part of a whole project, rather like ours was, the ionospheric project. It wasn't sort of a singular thing, and somebody cries, "Eureka, I've discovered something," you know. It was routine.
But on the other hand, was this the kind of work that gave Joe Farman and his team in the mid-80s the background information they needed to predict or establish the presence of global warming? Or the ozone hole, I should say.
In a way, yes. Not the Met itself, but the geophysics that they were doing at Faraday especially, and at Halley, but Faraday seemed to be the place. It was really... there's three guys involved in that, really. John Franklin, Brian... Oh, what was his other name? Little Scots lad. Very nice guy. Can't remember his second... His surname.
You mean in 85?
Yeah.
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 I know who you mean.
Yeah. Brian, John Franklin... and Joe were really the people behind that. Now, I think John, I'm not sure where Brian was, but I think John was actually on Faraday at that time, or had just come out, and it was his results that were causing speculation, if you like. But yes, that was the result of many years of routine observations, geophysic observations. So, yeah, it does bear fruit eventually. Well, some of it does.
There was also, of course, a political purpose of being there as well, wasn't
there? Oh, yes.
Was that something that was evident to you then, or has that only occurred to you later?
No, it was evident then, especially with the way things went by the time we'd come out. Almost certainly, you know, there was... You see, Argentina has always been the same. When it has internal unrest... It always points the finger at the Falklands, and it doesn't. You know, it's like depressions in this country. You know, you go through this cycle. So every so often, I mean, Argentina is a beautiful country. It's very rich in minerals, farming, agriculture, wine growing. You name it, it's got it. Mining, but they can't seem to get their act together. So every now and again, all the workers jump up and down, and they say, "We cannot tell a lie. It's the Falklands trouble." Yeah. You know. So everybody goes, "Aye." That's very simplistic, obviously. But
you were aware that you were a political presence, were you?
Oh, yes.
Were you blatantly aware?
No,
or something?
No, it was just something very much at that time in the background. But you thought, yeah, you know, it's the gate. I mean, South Dewey was the gateway to the Antarctic, really, that sector of the Antarctic. And, of course, everybody was claiming it. So, of course, there was little from the other bases, especially before my time. There would be protest notes flying backwards and forwards, and, you know, everybody was happy down there, but for the sake of their government's face, they'd present a protest note, and a little protest note would go the other way, and then they all get together and drink up, sort of thing, you know.
Was there any significant change in your second season, 61-62? Different base leader, of course, Mike Jarman.
Different base leader.
Different approach?
Yes.
In what way?
Very much left alone to get on with things. If we needed fuel or coal or whatever up, then it was a case of, or the chef wanted some food up, you know, saying, "Oi, we need a gang to go down." And then you say afterwards to Mike, "We've done this." So he didn't lead in the same way as Colin led, which is what we needed, I think, in that first season. In the second season, the base ran itself, because we all knew what what was required, if you like. So if you wanted a, somebody wanted a fuel, needed a fuel run, you used to go down and dig out a dozen 40-gallon drums and bring them up to base and then say to Mike, you know, put that in your report or whatever. So, yes, very different atmosphere.
Less fun, more fun? Same fun?
I think probably, I don't know, I mean, there was still the hilarity and the jokes and the, there was still the grumpy episodes, you know, where you maybe said the wrong thing at the wrong time to the wrong person and they took But it tended to blow over generally. But yeah, about the same. I mean, it is very interesting. I mean, I was told this when we went on base for the first time, that you were looked on as an alien, an interloper. And it is true, because you have your own little gang that have lived together for a year in very close proximity, and then all of a sudden you have all these strangers asking any questions. And I hope that doesn't sound too ungracious, as it were, but it's the way it is, I think, down there. And I'm sure it's still the same now. You know, if you've lived together, 7 or 8 of you now, during the winters at, say, Rotherer or wherever, and then this bunch come in and start prodding about and poking about and asking stupid questions, or what you consider stupid, because you know it anyway. And invariably everybody gets colds, because, of course, you're bug-free. So once you've had a cold down there, that's it, you know. Very rarely get ill down there. Actually, very unlucky.
Were you sorry to have to come away?
Yes. You feel, when you get on the ship, you feel as if you should be on the ice waving goodbye. A very strange feeling indeed. And especially seeing Stanley again, for example, which isn't exactly a great metropolis, but I mean, you think, God, cars. And I mean, arriving in Southampton, because I sailed back as well, of course, in that time, everybody did. The traffic was horrendous, absolutely appalling, you know. But you soon get used to it again. But
did you imagine you'd ever go back?
No, I didn't. I don't think the thought ever occurred. There are other things, you know, as I say, having been home 6 months, I was away again to Kenya for 9 months. And then even with Marconi, I was out of the office for 2 24 periods in any week for a lot of the time. When I was free, because I was working on a major government contract, when I was free of that, for whatever reason, either they'd run out of money or they were deliberating on something, I used to go off with the television survey teams. And, of course, at that time, they were surveying for colour TV. And that was quite fascinating, building a 150-foot mast and running around in ever-increasing circles doing survey readings of signal strength, etc., especially around Leeds and places like that, where you go down the back-to-backs and you'd have this extending mast on a Land Rover with an aerial on the top, which you can swivel. And all the women used to lean over their gates and think you were the television licensing people, and they did not like you one little bit. So quite interesting. Either that, or you'd be trundling along quite happily and there'd be a great big fizz and a bang and the mast would come down, you chop through a power line. So, yeah, interesting times.
Well, you did go back, and we'll discuss that every May on disc 2.
Yep, that's fine.